You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Dreeslein. We're going to have lots of outdoor topics to kick around here for the next hour. Good chunk of the show, middle section of the show, we're going to talk with someone from the Boone and Crockett Club about this big study they put together, this report, Poach and Pay, they call it. John Gassett is going to join us to talk in great detail about that. So looking forward to talking with him. We'll have Lesmeister a little bit later, but then for now, Tim Spielman is going to help me kick it off. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. And you had a front page story on how darn hot it was last week.
Yeah, it wasn't. Headline was off to a hot start, not in a good way, basically.
Right, right.
I'm not one of those, as I probably mentioned, that gets out right away on opening day. I know a lot of people are eager to do so, and I'm sure a lot of people obviously did. But you're talking up in my neck, it was probably in the low 80s, but I saw some highs in the 90s in southern Minnesota. And to me, that's maybe if you got out for a couple hours in the morning, but it wasn't exactly cooling off in the afternoon. So if you don't have any place to take your deer pronto, you know, after the after harvest, then you might as well just stay home, unless you just want to sit out there and watch the world go by, which is perfectly fine. Some people, I mean, I worked on deer stands just a couple nights ago. They weren't quite ready, but it was a little bit cooler, and that smell of fall was in the air, and the wind was whipping a little bit, and it's amazing how fast the leaves have changed on certain trees. You know, it's not the full-blown maple colors or anything like that yet, but, you know, even if you're not hunting, it's worth your time.
Yeah. Eric Morgan, our web editor, you and I have chatted about Eric and what a hardcore white-tailed deer hunter he is, big-time archer. I talked to him last Friday going into that weekend, and he sounded about as unenthusiastic about deer hunting as I've ever heard Eric. Yeah. You know, he was not looking forward to going out into the heat, but he was going to do it nonetheless. He was going to get out there and talk about maybe filling a doe tag and getting some venison in the freezer pronto. Yeah, I, you know, back in the day when I was a hardcore bow hunter, honestly, if it was that hot, I just didn't go out. That's me though. I don't like hot weather. And, you know, somebody said, you know, getting up in the morning this past week and going into work, I mean, you know, walking outside, it feels like a sauna at, you know, and it's mid-September. Definitely looking forward to some normal temperatures, which looks like we might be getting this week. Still not, you know, cool by any means. And we got fooled, didn't we, by that cool spell we had in the last week of August and the first week to 10 days of September, where it was abnormally cool. And I think some of us thought, oh, here we go. And then summer said, not just yet.
Yeah. Well, old Tim, who lives in an old farmhouse, pulled all his window AC units out, and he was regretting it a couple of nights ago.
Yeah, no doubt. Some good letters to the editor, Tim, in this week's edition. A lot of folks really like that old duck manager's commentary that you ran here a couple weeks ago. I liked it a lot, too. I commented on it. Dennis Anderson and I spoke about it on this show. And it definitely seemed to resonate with a lot of our readers who just don't feel like they're seeing the birds like they used to in the old days. And it garnered a bigger response from some of our readers maybe than I expected.
Well, I think even before that commentary, there were people who didn't like all the early seasons and the so-called early openers and the teal season. I mean, if you go back far enough, there were a lot of people who were opposed to the youth hunt just because it stirred up ducks, made them more wary, and the regular season just wasn't the same. And, Yeah, the teal season in, and the people who just want one darn regular season opener that just compounds it for them. And then you throw in the fact that the numbers that this old Duck managers group brought to the table. Again, I don't know if their recommendations would move the needle too much, but or if they're just feel good. It's probably somewhere in between. But I think a lot of the people who are chiming in the letters are longtime duck hunters, because I know a lot of younger ones who totally disagree. But again, this group is former duck waterfowl managers. So, I mean, their words probably carry a little more weight than that of your commoner on the street. I don't know. I mean, that's what they spent their lives doing. So I guess people sit up and listen maybe a little bit more.
I think you're right on. I also think you're right on that a lot of younger folks, they like these liberal seasons, the long seasons. They like that early teal season. They'll argue with you if you you start advocating to dial some of that back. So the DNR has got a number of constituencies that it's got to consider. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreeson and Tim Spielman are kicking off this week's broadcast. Just some other funny letters. There was one, the walleye limit. One guy said, don't mess with the walleye limit. Leave it at 6. And then another old guy, I assume he's an old guy, didn't want us messing with. He says there's too many trees on the landscape. We need more prairie programs. Fewer tree programs. It just struck me as funny what gets people worked up.
Yeah. Oh, and we just to add to the mix, we had one about the shotgun zone too, based on a story from a week ago, which was anti-rifle zone or basically pro-shotgun zone. So yeah, it was a good mix. There were a lot of points made. Letters are fun to read, and when we've got editions like this one and last week where there are several letters, I know a lot of people who go right to the opinion page first. They like the letters, they like the columns you and I write, and they generally like the commentary. So when there are a lot of letters and a lot of opinions and differing opinions, they're great additions to the paper.
We talked a little bit last week. We mentioned that the DNR's got its public comment period open until October 23rd on plans to really liberalize the bass fishing season for largemouth and smallmouth. Now, that's something that passed by law by the legislature, kind of giving the DNR its marching orders to basically implement a year-round bass season. I don't sense this is going to be real controversial. I guess they could potentially hold a public meeting if they got enough requests for one. But Natalie Ryder breaking that down in pretty good detail. If folks want to chime in, they got till a solid month to do so.
Yep. And if they want to, then by all means, go ahead. The DNR wants to get things in place so we can open that season next March. And I think part of that too is if you're going to do that, it's ideal to have that in the regulations instead of trying to explain it to people after the fact. So when they really want to have this ready to roll will probably be when they put the regulations together, I would think. It just makes more sense to be able to do it that way. But if for some reason there's outcry against it, which I don't anticipate, although Natalie did have someone who is not a fan, which is good. It's nice to hear if there's some opposition, and apparently there's a little bit out there, but I don't see it generating enough or there being enough opposition to warrant that hearing that they offer folks if there are enough voices out there. But you never know. That would probably delay it, I'm guessing, to some extent. But I think it's pretty close to a done deal.
This guy's take, Tim, was what? It was kind of unfair for some of the tournaments. Like you could have tournaments maybe kicking off in southern Minnesota, but the north half of the state still would be iced up. Was that kind of where he was coming from?
Yeah, I believe so. And it was more concerns about the number of bass being taken because of the new technology and that sort of thing. Yeah. But sure there's some of that. But if you're talking just after ice out and it's catch and release, I mean, there's just not a whole lot of hooking mortality.
Right.
That's what the studies have shown. I mean, that's what we base Mille Lacs take on is when the water heats up, then fish die a lot more frequently. But if you're talking just after ice out, I can't imagine there being a lot of that. And I don't know about some people, but when you catch bass, it seems like, at least the way I fish them, they're almost always hooked in the lip. Very seldom are you digging a hook out of a bass's gut, you know, like you would a walleye or a panfish that swallows a single hook and whoops, I guess I'm going to keep that 7-incher. But you don't see that with bass. I don't know if it's necessarily just the way they bite or the fact that you're using single hook on a spinner bait or something to that effect. But I don't see hooking mortality as a huge concern with bass when the water's cool.
And that's when the additional angling opportunity would exist, is during periods mm-hmm. when the water is cool. So right. yeah, the hooking mortality is going to be nil. Mm-hmm. Everybody's using forward facing sonar now. And I totally agree with what you just said about catching bass in the lip. I mean, most people catch a bass, they pull it up, they look at it, they pull that hook out quick, and it's back in the water in seconds. The whole tournament thing, though, was a wrinkle in this bass thing, Tim, that I guess I didn't consider. And I don't know if that's going to create some more ripples as this process unfolds. It's something I guess we can keep an eye on.
Yep, yeah. For sure.
All right. Well, Tim, thanks. Have yourself a good week. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, sounds good. You too.
Tim Spielman, editor at Outdoor News. Let's break. We're going to talk about this big Boone and Crockett study, Poach and Pay, when we return. This is Outdoor News Radio.
Whether you're hunting private or public ground, Onyx Hunt gives you the edge. With detailed land ownership maps, you'll know exactly where you stand. Add in advanced weather, wind, and radar tools, and you've got the full picture to plan every hunt. Now, with Moultrie Mobile Trail Cam integration, you can even see photos from your cams right on the map for smarter scouting and better stand decisions. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and start your free 7-day trial.
You're out here to catch fish, not chase eggs and milk around the woods. Chef Robert's Gourmet Breading Mix is built for the outdoors. One step, no mess, no fuss. Just wet it, bread it, fry it, and get ready for the crunch that legends are made of. Grab a 12-ounce resealable bag and feed the whole crew. Fish, chicken, turkey, duck, and more. Find Chef Roberts at chefroberts.com, that's chefroberts.com, and never miss a bite.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kinda be ready, be Plano ready.
Our outdoor heritage is at a crossroads. Fewer hunters and anglers means less support for the wild places we love. The Outdoor News Foundation is changing that story, one young person at a time. For just $25, you can give a child a year of outdoor knowledge via scholarships, learning camps, and access to OutdoorNews.com. Help us create a legacy for tomorrow's hunters and anglers. Visit OutdoorNews.com/foundation to get involved, learn more, and donate today.
Craig Engwall here from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association to talk a bit about chronic wasting disease. While CWD in deer is a serious matter, the situation is not hopeless. There are things that hunters can do right now to slow the spread of this fatal disease. For more information on what you can do regarding chronic wasting disease, you can go to the web and search Minnesota DNR, CWD, as well as the CWD Alliance. These web pages provide a great deal of information about CWD and the regulations pertaining to it. On behalf of MDHA, I want to thank you for doing all you can to protect Minnesota's wild deer herd from CWD.
I'm Chris Jakimic. I served in the United States Air Force, and I deployed 3 times. Being a veteran, it's interwoven into your DNA. It is really the absence of the connection and the purpose that can really drive a lot of veterans to some negative thoughts. For those who are in a suicidal crisis, the window of time to save somebody's life is very short. Our duty is to protect ourselves and protect our families. And one way you can do that is store your weapons safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the broadcast. Rob Gerisline with you for another segment. Hope you enjoy what we chat about here. If so, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. And you can subscribe to our print or digital content. Makes a great holiday gift. Yes, not too soon to be talking about the holidays. Hey, we had a big report come from the Boone and Crockett Club last week. Also, the Wildlife Management Institute was involved in this. It's called Poach and Pay Project. And hey, we got a lot of hunting seasons underway now. It's that time of year when folks are out hunting and mostly minding their P's and Q's. But this report that came out last week was really eye-opening. just in terms of understanding the volume of poaching that's occurring on the landscape in this country that we don't even know about. I'm really excited to have a guest with us. His name is Jonathan Gassett. He's with the Wildlife Management Institute. He's based down in Kentucky. He's a PhD who has a lot of experience with natural resources agencies around the country, Texas and Kentucky, most importantly, and he joins us now. John, thanks so much for carving out some time. Good to meet you face-to-face here.
Good to see you, Bob. I've heard your stuff and I've read a lot of the outdoor news stuff, but we never met face to face or face to virtual face, I guess.
Well, we were talking off, we got a mutual friend and Lou Cornicelli. So I know you're good people if you like Lou. So let's dive into this. First of all, let's talk a little bit about Boone and Crockett and Wildlife Management Institute. I think a lot of my regular listeners are familiar with the Boone and Crockett Club because of the trophy scoring record book. But Boone, BNC is involved in a lot of conservation efforts. And you're what, a professional member of BNC? You don't work for them, but you're a professional member. Tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, so both those organizations, Boone and Crockett and Wildlife Management Institute, are two of the oldest conservation nonprofits in the country that really specialize in wildlife conservation policy. Boone and Crockett, of course, was founded in part by Teddy Roosevelt, our president back in the day. And it wasn't founded to be a record-keeping or trophy club per se. What it was formed for was because we were losing all of our game species at an alarming rate because of market hunting, unregulated harvest, and basically people shooting animals for meat for restaurants and to feed folks. They realized that we may lose a lot of these, so they wanted to establish a collection so that, you know, folks in the future could see what these animals looked like.
Hey, Jonathan, can I just jump in with an observation? I don't think a lot of people understand what that term market hunting even means. That means that if you lived in New York City, there was like an open air market where you could buy deer or ducks or prairie chickens or buffalo hides or whatever back in the day. And that took a massive toll on the resources. And there's a reason now when you get your venison process, it says not for sale to this day on the packaging. You're not supposed to buy and sell, wild game meat so that we can protect those populations and have sport hunting.
That's right. And not only did it go to those open markets, it also went to the restaurants. Back then, a lot of the restaurants served wild game. It also got exported to Europe. You know, this country was basically founded on, you know, the beaver trade early on, the early explorers and trappers trapping beavers for Europe. And so basically they were trying to establish kind of a reference collection of here's what the big game species looked like at that time. But quickly it evolved into conservation efforts. So groups like Wildlife Management Area got formed. Ducks Unlimited, these other conservation organizations that we all know and love, all stood up then and said, you know, we have to do something about this. We have to stop the erosion of our natural resources in this country through unregulated hunting. So they started, state fish and wildlife agencies started getting established with an enforcement component first, and then later fisheries and finally wildlife became a part of those as well.
So the Boone and Crockett Club, they're based out in Missoula, Montana. And then WMI, Wildlife Management Institute, is in D.C. Is that right?
Are they? So we used to be based in D.C. In 2008, we sort of went to a dispersed model. So we all work from our own states now. Our fiscal headquarters is in Cabot, Vermont. And then most recently, our CEO and president retired, Steve Williams, Dr. Steve Williams. And
yeah, so I interviewed Steve a time or two.
Yeah. So our headquarters went from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, now to Nevada. Tony Wassily, the former wildlife director in Nevada, is our new CEO and president.
And what's your day job? You're the Southeast field rep. What does that mean for WMI? So what are you up to? What do you do?
Yeah, I have 13 Southeastern states that I handle. And we always joke about WMI because there's all these critter groups out there that specialize in certain critters or habitats. And we're more of a generalist and a policy shop. We sort of fill in the gaps between the critter groups, the nonprofits, and also the state fish and wildlife agencies and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So we try to find places where, you know, they don't quite meet up, and we bridge those gaps for them. There are things sometimes that we can say and do that obviously government officials and government staff can't do. So that sometimes weighs in.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Gerisline. We're chatting with Dr. Jonathan Gassett. He is the Southeastern Field Representative for the Wildlife Management Institute. He's also a professional member of the Boone and Crockett Club. Let's jump into the reason we're talking here today, Jonathan, and that is this big poach and pay project. The Boone and Crockett Club, as well as WMI, held a press conference last week announcing some of the results from this project. Let's talk about what motivated the Poach and Pay project, I guess, for starters. It's actually been going on for a number of years. Is that correct?
Yes, it has. In 2016, if you recall, 16, 17, we had an episode with Cecil the Lion, where an American hunter went to Africa, shot a lion.
He was a Minnesota-based guy. Yeah, we know all about that story. So
you know the story. Yeah. And ultimately, you know, was ostracized by the media and a lot of the public. And, and he sounds everything we've determined that he pretty much did everything right. He didn't post the line, but we saw this, the club saw this, the public starting to synonymize hunting with poaching. They don't discriminate between those two. And we said, well, we need to do something about that. So the first thing they did in 17 is they commissioned a survey through a contractor out of Montana to look at all the fish and wildlife agencies to look at the replacement cost for poached animals and to look at any obstacles to getting good prosecutions. And as no surprise, they found that while most states have replacement costs, some of them were substantially undervalued. And among other things, not the people themselves, but the court system process tended to be a barrier. If you think about taking a wildlife charge before court, it's dealing with murders and rapes and drug trafficking and all that. It doesn't stack up. So we saw that a lot of cases weren't making it through the process successfully. At the same time, well, a little before that was happening, and I have to back up here to my Kentucky Fish and Wildlife days when I was working there, we had a researcher who came in and wanted to look at citation data over a 10-year period to see how citations had changed over that time. In other words, you think about 10, 15 years ago, conservation officers were primarily focused on conservation and boating safety. And over time, we've seen that effort get eroded by more general policing activities as states require, they all have state police powers. So states require them to do or ask them to do more general policing type stuff. So we were looking at that in Kentucky. This researcher wanted to look at it for us. So we did a 10-year analysis. But what we found as part of that analysis was that the replacement costs were seldom applied to our poaching cases and that almost none of that money made it back to the agency. So even in cases where they were applied, the court systems never transferred the money back to us. And we found that we were losing millions of dollars a year in resources with no compensation for that loss. Incidentally, that researcher on that project was Dr. Christy Blevins, who's my co-researcher on this project.
Okay.
And she's also my wife. We met and we got married after all that. So poaching brought us together, I guess you could say.
Jonathan, we're going to need to get a break in here. And then I want to get into the real nitty gritty. But I don't want to leave listeners hanging here. I want to be clear. Kind of the money quote from all this is based on this research, we're seeing that only 4% of poaching incidents are detected. That means upwards of 95% of the poaching on the landscape no one even knows about. Is that correct?
That's what we think. That's what the numbers tell us. And it sounds shocking, but when you look at some numbers for other types of crimes, it's really not. It's really not that shocking.
With that, let's grab a break. You're going to hang with me for another segment? That's Dr. Jonathan Gassett. We're talking about a big poaching study that the Boone and Crockett Club unveiled last week. We're going to get into some of the more details here after this break. Stick around. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kind of be ready, be Plano ready.
Rapala's X-Rap is back, and it's bolder than ever with all new colors that light up the strike zone. From its legendary slash bait action to its classic Rapala wobble, the X-Rap's versatility puts you in control, whether you're ripping it fast or pausing for that perfect suspend. With long cast precision, flash foil tails, and hand-tuned, tank-tested performance, it's no wonder the X-Rap hooks pros and weekend warriors alike. Now available in all new must-have colors. Find your next go-to at Rapala.com or your favorite fishing retailer.
You fish the same waters year after year. But what if your next best fishing story is just a few miles away? Onyx Fish builds on 15 years of experience, giving hunters and adventurers a revolutionary angling tool to help you find new water, new access, and new fish. Find the right lake. Know the species, size, and abundance. Get expert local insight. Navigate to the right ramp fast. Then go fish in new lakes like they're your home waters. Don't chase reports. Make your own with Onyx Fish.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
The Outdoor News Foundation is dedicated to nurturing the next generation of outdoor enthusiasts. Through your generous donations, we provide youth with access to OutdoorNews.com, educational scholarships, and grants. Every dollar donated goes directly to connecting young people with nature and outdoor activities. Help us cast a legacy for the next generation of outdoor enthusiasts and conservation leaders. Visit OutdoorNews.com to get involved, learn more, and donate today.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again. Then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline with you here for another segment. Check us out online at OutdoorNews.com if you like the broadcast, or give us a call at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to our print or digital versions that way. We are going to continue our interview now with Dr. Jonathan Gassett. He's a Southeastern field rep for the Wildlife Management Institute. He's also affiliated with the Boone and Crockett Club. And both of these organizations last week had a big press conference where they announced some of the results from their poach and pay project. Dr. Gassett explained to us in a little detail here in the previous segment what motivated the research. And Jonathan, there's some really frightening results here. We started to get into it a little bit. Upwards of 95% of poaching incidents in this country might be completely undetected. How did you folks arrive at that number?
Well, it wasn't easy, and it took many years. This has been ongoing for about 5 years now. There's a lot we know about crime in this country, mostly because there are victims. There are identifiable victims. So you can do victim surveys. And there's a national victim survey called the National Crime Victimization Study. What that does is it's done by the Department of Justice every year. And they look at all the sort of human-on-human crimes, person-on-person crimes, and at what rate they get reported. We wanted to know about a crime, though, that this poaching is a very cryptic crime. If you think about it, there's not an identifiable victim other than the animal. But the public at large is the victim because all the public owns wildlife under the public trust doctrine. So you don't have someone who's personally injured in most cases for a poaching case or poaching incident. So it's really hard to figure out how many people actually do it and get away with it. We do know from the National Crime Victimization Study that the closest crime we can find to this is larceny, which is someone steals something from your property where there's no person-to-person contact. They steal your lawnmower while you're on vacation is a good example. Larceny is when they steal it when you're absent, but it's not inside your house, basically. We know that the reporting rate on that year after year is about 22%. So that's a quarter of those get reported, and that's people losing, motorcycles and lawnmowers and tools around the yard and those sorts of things. So when we heard that, it's like, well, if that number's there, and even crimes like violent crimes against people like rape and assault and aggravated battery are reported at about a 50% level, believe it or not. So that sort of framed where we're going to land. And then, knowing that it's a cryptic crime that occurs in remote locations where there's, in many cases, not a witness, you're really dependent on a lot of circumstantial evidence or people talking about what they did to catch them.
There's more trail cameras out there now. That's probably helping a little bit, huh?
True. If you can tell from a trail camera, unless you happen to catch them on camera illegally taking an animal or maybe dragging it in front of the camera, sure. It's sort of a shot in the dark, I think, with trail cameras.
We're calling this the dark figure of crimes that are undetected. And like we say, we're putting that at 95% when it comes to poaching. There's some big numbers associated with this. The minimum cost of poaching through loss, fines, and replacement costs for these animals is $1.4 billion annually. That's with a B.
That's a staggering number. That number is the equivalent of the total amount of excise tax on firearms, ammunition, archery equipment, fishing tackle, and motorboat fuels that comes through the federal government back to the states for conservation every year.
Oh, okay, hard stop. Sure. That's a really important figure you just cited. Yes. Because we drag that excise tax number out all the time. We're pretty proud of that number. Those excise taxes accomplish a lot on the landscape. And you're telling me that we're leaving that much on the table, on the ground out there in terms of poaching costs? That's a big number.
Yes. Yes. It is a huge number. It's also the equivalent, more or less, of the total amount of hunting licenses sold in this country every year. That's about $1 billion a year in hunting licenses every year. So that's a large number.
So the replacement cost for poached animals, wildlife on the landscape, is more than what legitimate legal hunters are paying for licenses?
Correct.
Oh, man. That's disheartening.
Isn't that disheartening?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Why is this happening? Are there enough conservation officers out there? You know, we've got 160 COs in Minnesota covering, 87,000 square miles, I think. I looked it up. You know, and I'm surprised. I was out wild racing last week, and a CO came out and checked us, and I was glad. You know, we were all fully licensed, and we were all proud to pull out our license, that sort of thing. So I'm amazed at what they are able to accomplish. But I guess, is it any surprise that this much poaching goes on when we have relatively few law enforcement officers involved with fish and wildlife enforcement?
It's not. There's a couple of criminal justice theories, and we mentioned those in this report. The routine activities theory is one of them. But basically, they all hinge on having an effective and responsible protector. In other words, it doesn't matter if the fine's $1 million a year. If there's nobody watching, then you never get caught. You never pay the fine. So without having sufficient eyes on the ground, yeah, they're going to do it. They're going to do these acts. And they pretty much do them at will. We catch a few, as the report mentions. But, you know, I had some officers that we surveyed in this report. Their coverage area would be 6,000 to 7,000 square miles for one officer. That's the size of Massachusetts or Connecticut.
You had a graph as I was going into some of the details of the research that talked about, I believe it interviewed hunters, landowners, and officers in terms of how serious this is on the landscape. And it struck me that I think of the three, officers were the ones that it really jumped out. They were sky high. Very serious. So these are the officers. They know what's going on out there. They know what they're not able to get to. And they're saying this is a very serious problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And even after the press conference last week, you know, I got calls from several officers that you know, spent 30 years in undercover units, which do a little different work than your average line officer out there and are much more in tune in many cases because they integrate themselves into some of these poaching rings. But he confirmed, he said, yeah, that you're probably pretty close on your 5% number. That's what we think as undercover officers. You know, that's what we think gets detected.
Was there any regional distinction within the study? You know, are there parts of the country where we think it might be worse than others? You mentioned out west where obviously you've got officers with so much more ground to cover. They've got a lot of ground to cover in Minnesota. Any regional aspects to this, Jonathan?
So there are some. We didn't go to that. We didn't go too deep into the report on that. Although we do know that obviously the land ownership patterns are a big part of it. So, you know, out in a state like Nevada, which is, you know, 95% owned by the federal government, there's even fewer watchers. There's no landowners aren't there. Okay. Hunters are only there in season. So it's like, what do you do when you know, the large majority of your state is all in public ownership, then your ability to watch and monitor those areas goes down greatly. And so what we saw from the officers, for example, in that part of the country, are that, you know, they had more concerns over poaching, especially on public land, than some of the eastern officers did because there's more public land there to poach on.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreesen. We're chatting with Dr. Jonathan Gassett from the Wildlife Management Institute. He was pivotal as one of the key researchers in a study called Poach and Pay Project that the WMI did with the Boone and Crockett Club. We're having a little fun here drilling into some of the details, trying to understand it. Jonathan, is there times of day that we think more poaching goes on? Did the study look at that at all? Was it able to scrutinize that? I presume a lot of this is happening at night. Maybe that's an obvious question, but I'm just wondering, any nuances in terms of when this poaching is happening that the study was able to tackle?
Not as far as timing of day. We just didn't get into that level. That would really require a deeper dive into citation data or poacher interviews themselves. And we did try to interview poachers.
Really? How did you try to do that? That's interesting.
Well, that was a big part of the proposal because Dr. Blevins, Christy, as I'll call her, y'all can call her, her students call her Dr. Blevins, but she's done a number of those studies, on these dark figure studies on things like burglary and some other crimes. But the people she interviewed were all incarcerated. Okay. And for a candy bar, they'll spend a half hour telling you everything, you know, that's ever happened to them. And we proposed that same concept for this study, not thinking about the fact that almost no poachers are incarcerated. So you really have to entice them to talk to you confidentially over, you know, a phone call or a video conference about, you know, what they've done and how many times they got away with it and how many times they got caught and what their motivations were. So we did have a few. We interviewed maybe a dozen or so that way, but far cry from where we wanted to be.
To get incarcerated for wildlife crimes, it's almost got to be federal, doesn't it? It's got to be poaching eagles or something like that.
It could be, but believe it or not, even some of those are not. It's really difficult to get incarcerated on a wildlife crime at any level in this country.
I'm curious, what did you learn from the poachers that you did interview who were willing to be interviewed? Any aha moments?
Most of them, they had their justifications lined very closely with what we anticipated and what we found in the literature. In other words, they seldom take responsibility for their action. Or they may say, yeah, I did it and I shouldn't have, but, you know, and it's always the but that gets you. But everybody else is doing it. Mm. Or, but my family needed that deer for food. Or, but the officer was a jerk. You know, it's like, okay, when you get to the but, you know, here the excuse is about to come. And that's what we found is that a lot of them would admit they did it and they shouldn't have, but they all had what they thought was a good excuse for it.
Before we let you go, Jonathan, okay, well, what are the recommendations? You've got a lot of data here, frightening data. Again, circling back to the, like I said, kind of the money quote from this thing, that 95% plus of poaching incidents in this country are undetected, the so-called dark figure of poaching crime. How do we fix this? What are the recommendations that BNC and WMI are going to push forward to try to get ahead of this and improve that number?
There's about 5 pages of best management practices on that report. So there's a lot of recommendations, but some of the top, you know, the top level ones are 1, convincing and informing the public that there's a difference between lawful regulated hunting and hunters and poachers. They are not the same. You know, you can drive your car on the road as long as you have a driver's license and a legal vehicle pretty much anytime you want to and no harm, no foul. But if you get intoxicated and drive it, you're driving illegal and you're not the same as a sober driver. There's a difference between someone committing a crime, even though they're participating in a similar activity, and somebody that's doing it the right way. So we have to get the public to understand that hunters are not poachers and poachers are not hunters. And as a matter of fact, they're the polar opposites. Yeah. One's stealing a resource and one is paying for that resource and the opportunity to pursue it.
Paying the public, paying the state for that resource.
Paying the state for that privilege, right? Mm-hmm. Not just through that, but also through the excise tax. Every time they buy a firearm or ammunition, they're paying 10 or 11% excise tax on top of that that goes to conservation. So educating the public, getting more eyes on the ground, whether that's more boots on the ground with officers, which is a strong recommendation we have. But also we found that of the landowners and hunters we surveyed, 50% of them said they had witnessed one of these events in the last 5 years, and only 50% of those people actually reported them. So 25% actually reported to law enforcement events that they had seen were probably illegal take.
We need people to let law enforcement know. And front cover of Outdoor News every week, Jonathan, we've got the Turn-In Poacher's phone number in there. There's no excuse for anyone not to have access to that.
And that's your landowners and hunters, which are, you know, while landowners are well, they're a different group. Hunters are, you know, we're not a minority. But if we get the general public aware of this situation and they understand and we make it easy for them to report when they see an incident, then we've expanded those eyes on the ground, so to speak. Yeah. You think about if every hiker, bird watcher, nature viewer, photographer out there understands what poaching is, and if you see something, say something.
Jonathan, thanks so much. I'm out of time, but you were a great guest. I had a lot of fun talking to you about this study. It's an important study. It's not necessarily fun. This is a serious topic. If folks want to read the study, they can go to the Boone and Crockett Club website. You can Google that up. It's just boone-crockett.org. And then that Poach and Pay Project button is front and center. Really easy to get to it if folks want to delve into more detail. And of course, in Outdoor News, we've reported on it extensively too, if folks want to dig into this deeper. But thanks so much for carving out all this time. Thanks for all you do and good luck moving forward with the project.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Have a great fall too. Hope you have some success afield.
You too.
Dr. Jonathan Gassett from the Wildlife Management Institute and Boone and Crockett Club. Appreciate him joining us. Again, check out that whole Poach and Pay Project study at booneandcrockett.org. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Whether you're hunting private or public ground, Onyx Hunt gives you the edge. With detailed land ownership maps, you'll know exactly where you stand.
Add in advanced weather, wind, and radar tools, and you've got the full picture to plan every hunt. Now, with Moultrie Mobile Trail Cam integration, you can even see photos from your cams right on the map for smarter scouting and better stand decisions. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and start your free 7-day trial.
Welcome to Crush City, where the fish are big and the bite is hot. Rapala, the world's number one lure brand, is bringing its legendary lifelike action to soft plastics. Crush City baits are already making waves in tournament circles, and now they're ready for your waters. Whether you're trolling shad wraps, casting X wraps, or shaking the Crush City mooch minnow, get out on the water and share your success with Rapala. Find yours today at your local fishing retailer or rapala.com.
Love the great outdoors? Then you need outdoor news in your life. Outdoor News is your go-to source for local hunting and fishing intel, conservation news, and outdoor adventure stories. Stay informed on seasons, limits, and the best spots to cast your line or set up your stand. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, Outdoor News has something for every outdoor adventurer. Subscribe today. Visit OutdoorNews.com or call 1-800-535-5191 to get started. Outdoor News, supporting the outdoor community since 1968.
Spring and summer are prime time for ticks that can spread Lyme disease and other infections. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would like to remind you to wear bug repellent when outdoors, shower as soon as possible after coming indoors, and check your whole body for ticks every day. If you've been bitten by a tick and develop fever, rash, or fatigue, seek medical care. To learn more, visit www.cdc.gov/Lyme.
Every year, millions of waterfowl wing their way across the continent in a display unmatched anywhere else in nature. Along the way, wetlands provide the resting places and critical resources these waterfowl need to complete their journey. But these rest areas for America's waterfowl and other wildlife are being degraded and destroyed. This is why, since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been a world leader in wetlands conservation, ensuring safe passage for nature's most beautiful creations, protection against flooding, and sanctuary for the human soul. If we don't want to grow old in a world without wild places, we must speak up, we must step up, so that we may fill the skies for generations to come. A public service from Ducks Unlimited.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. Final segment of this week's broadcast. Thanks so much for checking in with us here for another week. I'm Rob Gerisline. Tim Lesmeister is here to help me wrap up this week's broadcast. Read us both at OutdoorNews.com, or you can subscribe to the print edition by calling 800-535-5191. Again, you can subscribe to print or digital at OutdoorNews.com. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. We're into the heart of some hunting seasons. As we talked, we had archery seasons kick off last week for deer. This weekend, we got sandhill crane and woodcock both kicking off. Sandhill crane just limited to the northwest part of the state, but there's definitely a movement to increase the amount of hunting pressure on sandhill cranes in the region.
As they should. There's no shortage of sandhill cranes. I was driving into my place up here on Malin Island with a friend in my vehicle, and there were some sandhill cranes in my yard. I have an area that's treeless and a lot of grass, and the cranes love to go in there and pick away at bugs, I guess. And I mentioned that the crane season was going to be opening soon, and he couldn't believe that anyone would actually hunt sandhill cranes. I said, you know, they call these the ribeye in the sky, and they're supposed to be exceptional eating. I should know. I guess I've eaten them once or twice, and I don't find them as good as ribeye steak, but they're not bad if cooked properly. He just could not fathom the fact that you could actually kill and eat a sandhill crane.
Well, over in Wisconsin, they kind of revere sandhill cranes. Maybe not quite as much as we revere loons here in Minnesota, but quite a bit. I mean, Aldo Leopold wrote about sandhill cranes, and you know, you had artists like Owen Grammy who painted sandhill cranes. So they really love them over there. we've got a limited season in northwestern Minnesota. There's actually two populations of cranes in North America. There's this eastern flock that Minnesota represents the westernmost tip of that. The cranes we have in central and eastern Minnesota are this eastern flock that gets some hunting pressure, I think, down in the south, the Midlands, Kentucky, places like that. And then you got the big flock, the mid-continent flock that comes down through Manitoba, Saskatchewan, the Dakotas, and then they will stage in the Platte River there in Nebraska, and all the wildlife photographers from around the world descend on that in the spring because they get like 500,000 of those birds there staging in the spring, and there's hunting pressure on those birds in North Dakota, South Dakota, like you talked about. But we're kind of in the middle here, and it's kind of controversial. I think we could handle some harvest of that eastern flock here in Minnesota, but so far, it has not happened. There's people who oppose it. The northwest part of the state's far enough away from all the birders in the metro, I guess, that they don't care about that. But there's definitely interest in more or in some sandhill crane hunting in Wisconsin. There's an ample number of birds. When I go through places like Wisconsin and Michigan, I marvel at how many cranes I see hanging out almost in people's yards in exurban areas or in rural areas. And of course, a lot of farm fields. There's a lot of them over there. They could handle some hunting pressure, I definitely think.
Oh, absolutely. And boy, they're a noisy bird. If you've ever been under a flock of sandhills when they're cruising over the top of you, oh my gosh.
They're loud. I wouldn't call it noisome. I think it's an incredible call. I mean, they're definitely loud, but it's like this ancient sort of call. It's one of my favorite sounds out of doors, actually, Tim.
Yeah, I guess you make sense of that. I agree. But you know they're coming when they're flying over, that's for sure.
And they're smart. They're no dummies. I have hunted them in the Dakotas, and they are tough birds to hunt. But that is a real dark red meat. These birds eat vegetation. They eat crops. They eat insects. They're not fish eaters. I suppose one would probably eat a fish if they got it, but fish eaters generally don't taste real good, right? That's why one reason we don't hunt loons is because they eat fish. Anything that eats fish is usually pretty bad. That's not the case with sandhill cranes. They eat vegetation, they eat insects, and they deliver a real good. I mean, they look when you clean them up, it looks like a turkey, but it's red meat. It's not white like poultry.
Yeah, when you take one of those breasts and you slice it into strips, it looks like steak.
Yeah,
I think that's why they call it a ribeye in the sky. Boy, is it lean.
Another bird with red meat you can start hunting this weekend is the woodcock, and they'll start migrating out pretty fast. But they are migratory birds, and so unlike grouse, which hang around the state all winter, woodcock, it's kind of a short season. They'll move out fast, but not as much meat on a woodcock as a sandhill crane, Tim.
No, but they're fun to hunt.
Yeah.
I used to hunt woodcock in northeast Iowa. I've got a place down there, and they're not as plentiful as they used to be. But if you catch a good migration of woodcock, oh my gosh, they're so much fun. They eat worms and bugs and stuff like that. So I think they really like worms a lot. So if you've got like a side hill that's damp, you'll find those woodcock will come in there and they'll just hang right on the edge of the timber in the brush. Oh my gosh, I tell you what, it is incredible. But when they get up, they head right for the woods, and they literally, it seems to me like they're flying in ziggy-zaggy patterns, and it makes them really tough to hit.
Some good hunting advice there from Mr. Lesmeister if you're interested in chasing timber doodles. Outdoor News Radio, final segment of this week's broadcast, Tim and I bringing it home. I want to devote some time to remembering Robert Redford. Tim passed away, I believe it was a Tuesday, it was announced, Tuesday the 16th. He was age 89, apparently died in his sleep at his cabin, you know, in Utah. What a way to go. What an incredible life this man led. And I think he deserves a little applause from the outdoor community. This guy did some pretty amazing movies out of doors, and he was a hardcore conservationist in his life, too.
Yes, he was a hardcore conservationist. You know, he was the one that fought tooth and nail to preserve that. It's called the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. This is 1.7 million acres in Utah, which became a protected site in 1996. Why? Because this guy, Robert Redford, decided he wanted that area to be left pristine. So, and that's twice the size of Yosemite National Park.
Bigger than the boundary waters. Yeah.
You bet. You're talking about somebody that was a very serious conservationist who worked very, very hard to make sure there were lands in this country that were left untouched.
Yeah, and made some great movies involving the outdoors. Jeremiah Johnson back in the 70s, and then, of course, A River Runs Through It, which he did not appear in A River Runs Through It, although he did the voiceover. The guy had a great voice, in addition to being, let's face it, one of the best-looking men in the history of Hollywood. He had a great voice, too, and his narration of A River Runs Through It still resonates with anyone who's ever seen that movie.
That movie almost didn't get made. It was first given, but to someone else, paid for rights to it that expired. Norman MacLean got a really bad taste in his mouth for Hollywood, wasn't going to do anything with it as far as movie until Robert Redford came along. Met with him a few times and basically talked him into it. Then MacLean, it's sad because MacLean died right before that movie came out. Great cast. A lot of people said it was kind of arrogant of Robert Redford to narrate that movie. He was directing it, and he did anyway, and it turned out to be a huge hit. And then that's funny how Hollywood works. They were, trying to beat this thing down many, many, many times, and he stuck with it, and it just turned into a phenomenal movie that, people look back and go, wow, I think I probably should have supported that. He persevered.
I love that movie a lot. Of course, it's about fly fishing, but if anyone who watches that film, the reason it's popular with so many people who have never touched a fly rod is because it's ultimately a movie about family. And I think everyone who's ever watched that film can recognize some of the different characters in that movie, people in their own lives, and the fly fishing. And it was also about parenting, about a parent teaching his sons how to discipline and how to do something well. And, it could have been anything, right? It could have been, about sports, about baseball or crew or canoe building. You name it. Who knows what it could have been about? But obviously fly fishing, a very elegant sort of activity out of doors. And it's something that occurs in beautiful places. So it lended itself to cinematography. But, in addition to his outdoor movies, just great storytelling, involved in some great pictures, The Sting, Butch Cassidy, the Natural. I don't know how you feel about The Natural. That's another one like Dances with Wolves, as I said, that feels a little corny to me now. But at the time, I just loved that movie in the mid-80s when that came out.
Geez, he was in The Way We Were with Barbara.
With Babs, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Great Gatsby, Out of Africa. All phenomenal movies, All the President's Men. The guy started Sundance. I mean, think about that. This is a festival that's still going on today that, showcases movies that may never see light of day.
Tim, there was this anecdote on social media from Mike Nichols, great director, did some phenomenal movies. The guy who did The Graduate. And Robert Redford auditioned for The Graduate. Nichols said, I interviewed hundreds, maybe thousands of men for the role before his conversation with Redford turned out to be a short one. He said, you can't play the role, Bob. You can never play a loser. And Redford said, what do you mean? Of course I can play a loser. And so Nichols said, okay, have you ever struck out with a girl? And Redford said, what do you mean? And Redford wasn't joking.
Yeah, I don't think so. Take a look at Bob Redford and you can probably realize almost immediately that he's never struck out with a girl.
Greatest hair in the history of Hollywood, you think?
Yeah, I think so. There's no doubt in my mind.
All right. Well, rest in peace, Robert Redford. What an incredible life. Someone that you thought would never die. It just seemed like he'd be around forever. But thank you for your contributions to conservation and to American storytelling. With that, Tim, thanks for sharing some of those memories with me.
All right. We'll catch up to you soon.
Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. Everybody, have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline, signing off for Outdoor News Radio.
Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.